All right, we're going to get started right now with Emily Kobe-Baman's presentation. She's the director of the UCAR Community Programs, and she'll be speaking on that topic.
Thank you very much. I realize when I stand up here just how tall Jim Hurl is. And it happens because we're often slated exactly this way, right? Because he goes first and then I go, and I'm forever having, and it's the only time I have to do it is to fold it down is after I come after you. So I am Emily Kobe-Baman. I'm the director of UCAR's community programs, and what I want to do is take about 10 minutes here to talk about what UCP is up to these days. Many of you are familiar with some of our programs. I'm hoping that by the end of this 10 or 15 minutes, I give you a sense of not only where these programs have been, but some of the exciting new directions that we are undertaking. I have been on board for about 15 months now, and have seen quite a bit of change within the programs. We are 8 extramurally funded programs with a wide variety of national and international sponsors, about $45 million a year. Before I came on board, these 8 programs really functioned fairly autonomously, right? They have their own sponsors, they have their own community, they have their own missions. Many of them have their own strategic plans. And the one thing that they all have in common is they really operate in that space of operations to service. So if NCAR is the research hub of the UCAR organization, we really represent the service part of the organization that supports not only the translation of NCAR science to end users, but also of the science done at our 103 institutions. We're about 250 folks at UCP, largely engineers, instructional designers, educators, logistics support specialists. And really our goal here is to provide innovative resources, tools, and services that support the research and education goals of the entire weather climate enterprise. And I'll talk a little bit about sort of where we're headed in that direction over the next few minutes. We have a number of capabilities, some of which you're very familiar with, data visualization and archiving. You'll hear a lot from Mohan in a few minutes. A lot of education and training, public outreach, K-12 education, undergraduate opportunities, and then this really important competency-based training that Rich Jeffries will speak to. In addition, we have another suite of programs that really focus on supporting the scientific endeavor, from program support for CLIVAR and USGCRP, staffing solutions. You heard a little bit about the Visiting Scientist Program. VSP has one magical secret that MEG appears to have almost an unlimited access to H-1B visas, making it very useful for doing foreign exchange. And then we support a number of science operations. Unlike NCAR, which is very NSF-focused, our biggest sponsors are NOAA, certainly NSF, NASA, but that portfolio is diversifying very quickly. We have a new foundational budget process that allows us to go down that road. We certainly spend a fair amount of time working with the Business Development Office in UCAR looking at commercial enterprises for this very interesting niche that Tom referred to, the hub between the public, private, and academic set of partnerships. As I said, you're going to hear talks both by Rich Jeffries on his competency-based training and Mohan on community data. What I'm going to do is talk just for a few minutes about our STEM education programs and climate services, because these really represent sort of the two new areas that we have been focusing on over the last year and a half. And let me put it this way. 5 of my programs really sit in that space of education and training. But in the last year and a half, we've begun to ask the question, what can we do together that makes us stronger than the sum of our parts? And it turns out that if you take a look at where GLOBE sits with its international footprint, where the UCAR Center for Science Education sits with its teacher professional development, where Digital Learning Sciences sit with its virtual education and hosting the National Science Digital Library, we really have a set of programs that touch each other but don't really overlap very much, which is good for me, because if they overlapped with each other, then fighting ensues and crying happens, and it's really not very good. What we have been doing with these programs is looking at a number of different areas where we can extend our national and international reach. Many of you know the GLOBE program. It sits in 112 countries, reaches about 25,000 teachers a year. We've been asking Tony Murphy to stand up a little bit more in the international education community. He's just become the North American representative for the International Council on Education for Teachers. We have strong partnerships with NSTA, with the Association for Science and Technology Centers, with the Smithsonian Institution. We have begun now to extend those partnerships to UNESCO, to a number of the international education programs where STEM education really is often lacking, and so there's a place for us to play there. We are spending a lot of time focused on the new national standards in the United States, but also taking a look at international science and STEM education standards to see how our materials can map on to things that particularly countries, developing countries, need. The areas that these organizations play in most is in virtual teacher education so that we can bring that expertise internationally. Online education communities where we really have a solid core of educational researchers that are focused on how do you marry curricular assets with things like UCAR Connect in a virtual environment that allows teachers to get the support that they need, particularly when they're often very remote. And we focus a lot on underserved students, teachers from underserved areas, and particularly rural areas. Another area that we have some growing expertise in is this idea of community engagement in science, so citizen science and community engagement. Those are probably the three key areas that this suite of programs focuses on. One of the areas that very quickly became apparent when I came on board where UCP has a very interesting role to play is in the area of climate services. There's no question that NCAR also has a role here, and it's actually one of those really nice areas where NCAR and the university community can partner with UCP to really provide an end-to-end delivery of climate data that meets end users' needs. So if you take a look at this slide, really the things that you see at the top here really fall into the NCAR category, right? The Earth system observations and the modeling, the translations of impacts, some of the data and visualization, but somewhere in that middle part of the slide is where the UCP piece of this takes over. So if you think of NCAR as research to operations and UCP as operations to service, you see that bottom part, middle to bottom part, is really where we have been spending a lot of our time. And what it really comes down to is that while for the scientific community, open access to data is first and foremost. I think you've heard that already. You will hear more of that from Mohan, certainly. For us, that's really where the conversation begins, right? And actually, about 9 months into my tenure as UCP director, I realized what it was that UCP programs have in common, this disparate group of 8 programs. All of them start with the end user and work back to the science. Right? They are all focused on what end user needs are and how you bring that science to them in a way that makes them able to use it in their decision making, in their education and training, and so forth. So for us, the areas in the last year where climate services has really focused is in taking a look at that evaluation from data to the end user. And it's not just about needs assessment. It really goes well beyond that. It really goes into what we use often in the educational community in terms of formative and summative evaluation that really lets you know that the climate product that you're developing is meeting your end user's needs. And I'm not talking about the scientific efficacy here. I'm talking about your ability to communicate it and communicate it in a way that end users feel part of that conversation. I hear a lot of conversation about end user driven science priorities or end user driven service priorities. Well, one of the ways that happens is through the dialogue that is a result of this kind of evaluation. We're in the process of working with a number of organizations, including the Climate Services Partnership and IRI, to some degree with the UK Met Office and Chris Hewitt, to establish a climate services evaluation framework. Now, it turns out that IRI had already started down this path and has put out some really lovely papers, none of which actually had an evaluator associated with them. So they never have I seen actually a community who has set up all of its needs, right? And then ask the evaluation community to step in. But that's really where climate services is at this point. And I think we'll see over actually the next 4 to 6 months, those partnerships grow and an establishment in a fairly coherent way about what that evaluation framework needs to look like in order to increase our ability to meet end users' needs. I think another area that we're starting to spend more time looking at is in this idea of effectively scaling climate services efforts. There's no question that the need out there is so great that no single organization can meet every end user's need. And there's a place for virtual space to play in here. There's a space for increasing the training and education pieces here. But it turns out that many of the things that climate services, those communities are identifying as their scaling problems, are exactly the kinds of scaling issues that education folks have been dealing with for the last 10, 15 years. And so we're hoping to take some lessons learned from that community to bring it over to climate services to help begin to address the scaling problem. I think I'm going to stop there because I know that Mohan has a lot to say, and so does Rich. I'm delighted to be here, happy to answer any questions that you may have, but we would probably want to save as many as we can for later, given our time constraints. How's that?
Well done.
Thank you. Thank you. I was told to be fast.
I'm just going to ask a question. So I think it's a challenge to, present all this information in a short period of time, but there is room for discussion. And one immediate point I just like to raise, I guess, is a comment that I'll try to turn into a question. It's difficult for several of us in the on the academic side who are tend to be specialized, focused on STEM itself, on the actual research, right, to identify potential end users. And sometimes we have help from our institutions, our universities, to do this. Often we don't. Do you have a concrete example of, say, university researchers outside, either, I guess, in who are working closely with NCAR or even outside, because you mentioned that you partner, outside the immediate NCAR group, who have made that kind of connection through one of your programs?
Sure. Actually, one comes immediately to mind. So we have been doing a fair amount of work with Iowa State University in the area of food security, agriculture, and climate services with Gene Tackley. When we went out to visit them in November, one of their education offices, it's called EPSCoR in the United States, came to us and said, in a year and a half, we lose our EPSCoR status, which means we have to be able to, so EPSCoR, it, help me, what does EPSCoR stand for? It's basically a designation given to a number of states that have not traditionally had strong research pieces in that state. And so initially it was established, I think there were 13 EPSCoR states. Now everybody's an EPSCoR state except for Colorado. As a result, they get preferential treatment from our National Science Foundation. There are special programs for them, and money flows into that state to support building the research capacity. Right, and so losing this status means they're going to lose money, and particularly their education piece of the university was going to lose money. And they came to us and said, look, we have agricultural agents that work in every single county in Iowa, and we have scientists who have important science education or science to bring to students in all of those counties. So we have the mechanism and we have the science, but we don't really know what goes in between. And so the first thing that we did was we put them in touch with the UCAR Center for Science Education, who said, look, your state has this set of state standards, and here is everything that we have that meets all of those state standards, grade by grade. So here's a framework and all the materials already ready to go. Why don't you start with this? Then they came back and said, well, that's great, but in order for us to be competitive, to go out and get our funding to continue a lot of these programs, we need to know something about evaluation. And it turns out that the School of Ed does not sit at Iowa State University. It sits at the University of Iowa. And so we said, well, we have an evaluator who you can build into your proposals. That person can be your external evaluator to demonstrate the efficacy of what you do so that you have that data to make your case as to why what you're doing is effective. It's that kind of service to the universities that I think serves as a model for what we're trying to do. Does that help you?
Yes, it does.
Okay. I'll be around all day. I have no idea how to get out of this.